Representative Swatsky, you'll come to order, please.
Okay. Okay, sir.
And the rest of us, too. Have we ever had a joint meeting? How can we approve any minutes here? Okay. Well, it's 9:10 and on April 28th, and we are calling the meeting of the joint hearing of the House Committee on Transportation Policy and Senate Transportation and Public Safety Committee to order. And Senator Dibble is doodling with the light rail situation somewhere in the regions of the Capitol, and we have a substitute, Senator.
Good morning.
Good to see you this morning. Oh.
Thank you.
This is going to be, first of all, an informational hearing on the Legislative Auditor's Report on MnDOT selection of payment services for road rehab. And we have Jody Hauer and John Chigalow, Engineering Services Division Director and Office of the Legislative Auditor is Jody from. Please begin.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Jim Nobles, Legislative Auditor, and with me at the table is Jody Hauer, who's going to make a presentation of our report. First of all, Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for having us here. It was members of the House and Senate Transportation Committees that asked us to do this evaluation. And we appreciate that because it helped plunge us deep into one of the perennial mysteries of state government. And that is, does MnDOT have an adequate process for deciding whether to select concrete or asphalt to rehabilitate roads? As we were asked to do this evaluation and talk to some of you and others, they often referred to that process as a black box. So I think what we did is Jody and also David Greenwood Sanchez, who's over here, helped her. They got out their flashlights and went into the black box to try to figure out what's going on in there. And this report, I hope, will help illuminate and help you understand better what is going on in that decision-making process. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to call on Jody Hauer, who was the manager of the evaluation, to make a presentation of our report. And again, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the Joint Committee, I am Jody Hauer, for the record, with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Well, in this report, we looked at how MnDOT decides between using concrete or using bituminous when it comes to choosing a pavement type for the road rehabilitation projects. Now, as you may know, the bituminous and the concrete paving industries compete for MnDOT's road projects, and issues that those two industries have raised in the past led, at least in part, to this evaluation and the report that we'll be talking about today. Just by way of overview, one of the issues that has been raised in the past, at least by the concrete industry, is whether MnDOT favors bituminous over concrete when it comes to selecting pavement type. In general, we did not find that MnDOT's process favored one pavement type over the other. However, we did identify some deficiencies in the process that MnDOT follows, which could lead to a disadvantage for either the concrete industry or the bituminous industry. And I'll get back to this more in just a moment. A bit of background on the evaluation. We had two major components in this evaluation. The first one, we reviewed national literature that's out there on how to select. What are the best practices involved, the recommended practices involved in selecting? Once we identified those practices, then we compared MnDOT against them. And then in the second component of our research, we selected a sample of MnDOT's rehabilitation projects from the past 5 years. And we looked at those projects to determine how well they complied both with state law as well as MnDOT policy on this topic. Now, overall, we concluded that MnDOT does meet many of those recommended practices that are in the national literature, but we do believe that it needs to make some changes in order to improve its process for selecting pavement type. And that will be the balance of the rest of my presentation. On this next slide, I'm going to quickly go through the major findings that we concluded as a result of our work, and then I'll spend a little bit of time on each of them, and then we'll go for questions. So the first finding that we reached was that MnDOT has not fully identified all of the feasible pavement alternatives that are out there to make road fixes. Second, in the life cycle cost analyses that MnDOT conducts, MnDOT follows many of the practices that are recommended in the national literature, but not all of them. Third, MnDOT does not weigh all of the economic and non-economic factors that could affect the pavement alternatives that are under consideration for any given road fix. And fourth, in Minnesota, we have a state law that requires life cycle cost analyses to be conducted, but our law unnecessarily requires comparing pavement alternatives that have equal design lives. And again, I'll get back to this in a moment. Finally, MnDOT's process of alternate bidding, which is a process whereby road projects are open to bids from both of the paving industries, both concrete and bituminous, that process has had limited impact. So, a little bit more on that first finding. One of the first things that the national literature identifies is that the transportation agency that has to select between pavement types should have a full range of the potential pavement alternatives that could be used to fix any segment of the road. And to do this, the agency should rely on data on the conditions of that segment of the road, as well as the history of the construction of that pavement and the pavement distresses. Now, MnDOT does this. It uses historical data in coming to its decision about what pavement alternative ought to be used. And this is part of MnDOT's pavement management system. And this management system suggests certain road treatments for the segment of the road that's under consideration, based on the history of that segment and based on data it has collected in terms of the condition of that pavement and also on the distresses that are evident in that pavement. But the problem is that this pavement management system is not complete as it now sits. So for instance, for concrete, the system does not include white topping or thin white topping as one of the pavement alternatives. And this is where new concrete is laid over bituminous that has had certain distresses. And also, the system does not include, on the bituminous side, doesn't include full depth reclamation, which is a technique that's used when the existing pavement and a portion of the underlying base are then pulverized to create a new base. So typically, when this has occurred in the past, MnDOT's materials engineers out in each of the 8 districts around the state come in and use what they know about the road system. They have a lot of experience. They use their knowledge of their road systems to identify what is an appropriate road rehab strategy. But they have hesitated to identify things like thin white topping in the past because MnDOT had not approved any design standards for the use of thin white topping. So in our report, we recommend that MnDOT complete identifying a full range of all the feasible pavement alternatives that could be used for road rehabilitation. And in fact, MnDOT has already taken steps to do this. In fact, in January of this year, so just a few months back, MnDOT did adopt design standards for use of thin white topping, which is something they hadn't done before. Not having these design standards in the past was to the detriment of the concrete industry, because that particular option really wasn't on the table when an engineer was looking at all the possible alternatives that might be used. But it became possible to adopt these design standards very recently because a University of Pittsburgh study that was concluded at the end of 2013 provided some of the empirical and research-based evidence that the department felt it needed in order to put together the design standards that could be used department-wide. And this research that was done through the University of Pittsburgh included a design guide that helps engineers understand what are the best circumstances under which a thin white topping might be used. So consider that a step in the right direction. We also examined the recommended practices in the national literature on the life cycle cost analyses. And as I suggested earlier, we have in state law here in Minnesota a requirement that MnDOT put together a life cycle cost analysis comparing the alternatives for any segment of road that needs to be rehabilitated. And the purpose of this life cycle cost analysis is to contrast comparable costs of the competing pavement alternatives. So this slide shows us how it might be done for a 6-inch white topping. So first, the MnDOT district will lay out what is the initial cost of this particular alternative. And you see here in this first row, pavement age 0, it hasn't been constructed yet. The initial cost, a little bit over $403,000 per mile. So the districts will, once they have that kind of initial cost and the initial treatment underway or in part of their consideration, then they start thinking, well, what will be the future cost of laying a 6-inch white topping? And you can see that the future work then is estimated that at pavement age 12 in the second row of this particular table, some minor concrete rehabilitation would be needed. Again, the cost is there. And you see in that final column what's called present worth. The districts will, for each time they estimate what the future cost will be, they will use a discount rate, apply it to that cost, and bring it back to present-day value. So that final column in this chart shows you what the present-day value would be of these future maintenance and future rehabilitation efforts that are connected to the 6-inch white top. Additional work would be needed at pavement age 20 with some major concrete rehabilitation, and again at 30 years of age. They also will look at any remaining service life that would be available at the end of this analysis period, which is for the most part going to be 35 years. A few exceptions, but for the most part will be 35 years. If there is service life remaining, as in this example there is, the value of that service life is subtracted out from the other costs, and then the costs are totaled. And then this is going to be done, the same kind of process is followed for each of the competing pavement alternatives being considered for this particular segment of road that needs the rehabilitation. So they'll come up with a total cost then after subtracting out the remaining service life value for that particular 6-inch white topping treatment. And then the point is to have then for each of the pavement alternatives a life cycle cost analysis that will show all the present costs as well as the future costs, subtracting out that remaining service life, and then they'll be able to compare comparable costs for the different segments. In this case, the 6-inch white topping turned out not to be the low-cost option, and as you can see in that bottom row, it was actually 12 percentage points higher in cost than its competing alternative. But this is the process that's typically gone through to arrive at the point where the department can identify what is the low-cost alternative. And typically, the low-cost alternative is the one that's selected for that pavement rehabilitation. Now, the national literature that we examined recommended 7 key practices related to putting together a good, sound life cycle cost analysis. I'm not going to talk about all 7 of them, but I will talk about 3 that we thought were particularly important. And the first is that when agencies estimate what the costs are of that rehabilitation, that they rely on historical bid data to come up with the costs, which MnDOT does, and that the agency use cost information that reflects the market prices of that particular technique, that particular road fix, at the time that it would be constructed. So we looked at the age of the cost estimates that MnDOT used in its life cycle cost analyses for a sample of their projects. And this particular bar chart shows the results after we looked at 40 sample cases. And you can see that the white segment of this particular bar, 70%, that indicated the segment so that most of these 40 projects did have cost estimates that were less than a year old at the time that they were let for bidding. A reasonable amount of time had passed. However, we saw that cost estimates in about 5% of our sample were more than 2 years old, and that's depicted by the red segment of this bar chart. And then another 5% in the yellow segment of the chart had cost estimates that were more than 3 years old. So in total, about 10% of this fairly small sample of projects had cost estimates that were at least 2 years old. And consequently, let me go on to a couple of other of the findings that we had on the life cycle cost analyses, and then we'll talk about the recommendations for each one of them. So a second recommended practice in the literature for life cycle cost analyses is to quantify what are called supplemental costs. And these are the costs that include what the agency has to spend for things like administering the contracts, their engineering costs, testing the materials, and the like. However, in MnDOT's process, they do not consider the supplemental costs when they're comparing the competing payment alternatives. Then a third recommended practice is to estimate the cost to the road users, the people that have to travel through the work zone when the rehabilitation and when the maintenance is being done. And those costs typically are estimated in terms of what the delay cost is, the time delay cost for those drivers, as well as the vehicle operating costs. And we did learn that many of the materials engineers out in the MnDOT districts do informally consider some user costs, but we concluded that MnDOT does not have a formal evaluation of the user costs when it makes its decision about which of these pavement types ought to be used. So, in response to our findings on the life cycle cost analyses, we recommend these three things. First, that MnDOT set a policy on when the cost estimates should be updated so that they're not dealing with outdated cost estimates when it comes time to make the decision. We also recommend that MnDOT assess differences in the supplemental costs, the administrative costs that the department incurs between the pavement alternatives. And if those supplemental costs do differ significantly, those should be taken into account when they're making a decision about which of the competing pavement alternatives ought to be used. And then third, we recommend that MnDOT have a process for estimating the user costs so that that becomes more of a formal part of the consideration among the competing pavement alternatives. We think this is important so that it's dealt with on a consistent basis from one district to the next and from one project to the next around the state. It's recommended, again, in the national literature that once the agency has constructed the life cycle cost analyses for each of the competing pavement alternatives, that it sort of step back and evaluate those pavement alternatives against several economic factors as well as several non-economic factors. And a couple examples of the non-economic factors are things like the noise that might be generated during the time that the construction is underway, or local government preferences for the type of pavement that's being selected. The literature also recommends that the agency use a formal decision-making tool to weigh what these economic and non-economic factors might be for the competing alternatives. Now, MnDOT does consider most of the economic factors that are recommended in the national literature, but it does not formally consider many of the non-economic factors. So we recommend that MnDOT begin to use a formal process that will routinely weigh a combination of those economic factors and non-economic factors that could affect what the pavement alternatives would really mean. Now, Minnesota's law on life cycle costs says that MnDOT has to compare these pavement alternatives, but that the alternatives should have equal design lives. The problem, or one of the problems, is that this term equal design lives is not defined in law, nor is it defined in MnDOT's policies. And after we talked with materials engineers and we examined life cycle cost analyses from the different districts, we found that this term is actually interpreted very differently. But more important than that is that even though our law does require having alternatives that have equal design lives, it's really not necessary. The national literature says absolutely nothing about needing alternatives that have equal design lives. And furthermore, fair comparisons of those alternatives will result if the agency follows the recommended practices for life cycle cost analyses. So for instance, as long as the department is using the same analysis period, that 35 years I talked about earlier, for each of the pavement alternatives being considered, and as long as it analyzes any remaining service life that might be there at the end of that 35-year period and follow the other recommended practices, the process will result in the low-cost option. And that is regardless of whether or not you started out with alternatives that had equal design lives, regardless of how you might define equal design lives. So we recommend that the legislature repeal this requirement for equal design lives in the life cycle cost analyses. I'm going to talk next about alternate bidding. And this is a process whereby MnDOT itself will not be selecting the type of pavement used for a rehabilitation. So instead, for certain projects, MnDOT will produce two different designs and then open the project for a single project, and then open that project to bid from both of the industries, both concrete and bituminous. And the pavement type selected then is the one that's associated with whichever bid is the winning bid. And one of the primary reasons for using the alternate bidding process is that it can increase competition between and among the industries and the industry corporations, which then theoretically will lead to lower costs. A good thing, I think, in all of our eyes. What we found is that, first of all, MnDOT has not had many alternate bid projects. They've had 26 over the last 5 years. That represents about 6% of all the pavement projects that they've had in that time. And one of the problems is that of most of these 26 projects, only one industry actually submitted a bid. So on this particular pie chart, the red slice indicates that no contractor bid on the concrete alternative in 50% of these 26 alternate bid projects. The green slice shows that another 8% of the projects, no contractor bid on the bituminous alternative in the alternate bidding projects. Beyond that, a report was issued in January by MnDOT that had compared these alternate bid projects with the traditional rehabilitation projects. And it found that the alternate bid projects did not produce any savings in the unit pricing of the materials that were being considered, nor did it expand the number of contractors that were bidding on these alternate bid projects. So we recommend that MnDOT change its alternate bid project process. We think that there is potential for it to be useful. We don't think it should go away. We do think it should be improved. And one of the things we suggest as a possibility is narrowing the criteria that the department uses to identify those projects that are most likely to benefit. And it seems pretty clear that the ones that are most likely to benefit are those where the cost between the competing alternatives are, the difference in the costs between the competing alternatives is rather low. So in sum, I'm going to go through our key recommendations, then I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have. We had several key recommendations for the department. First, we said the department should identify a full range of all the feasible pavement alternatives that could be considered for a road fix. We recommend that the department improve provisions that relate to those life cycle cost analyses, and that includes things like updating cost estimates when they no longer reflect market conditions. It also includes quantifying the cost for MnDOT's contract administration, materials testing, and the like. It includes estimating costs to the users that drive through those work zones when the work is underway. We also recommend that MnDOT use a formal decision-making tool that will weigh the economic factors and the non-economic factors that could influence those competing pavement alternatives. And finally, we recommend that MnDOT change that alternate bidding process. We had just one recommendation to the legislature, and that was the repeal of the language in statute on equal design lives regarding the life cycle cost analyses. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I'll conclude my remarks. I'd be glad to answer questions or come back after Mr. Chigla has a chance to speak on behalf of the department.
I want to apologize to Mr. Nobles. I was reading off my agenda, and his name wasn't on there. So I apologize. It's your office that's doing this whole thing, and thank you for that. Sterling work, as usual, I'm sure, and apologize again. I do have a question, and that is, what do you mean by the traveler's costs that are calculating user costs incurred by travelers, estimating users' costs? I mean, what does that mean?
Mr. Chair, the traveler's costs include the time delay that the drivers might experience as they're going through a work zone. It also includes the cost, the vehicle operating costs that might be increased because of the slowdown in the travel through the work zone. And those types of costs, although it might seem like, well, how does that get estimated? There actually are software programs that can be used to help estimate what those costs are.
Doesn't mean the kind of pavement that sound that they're driving on. It's the work zone slowdown. I understand. Cost of delay and so forth. Okay.
Senator Peterson has a question.
Yeah.
Senator Peterson has a question.
Senator?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, were you willing to take some questions now, or did you want to wait?
Well, I don't see any reason why not. We take them now on each part of the...
Sure. One of the questions I had, and I'm not sure if you looked at it, you know, Minn Road is celebrating its 20th year. That's the Minnesota Road Research Project there out near Monticello. And so it's, you know, it's probably, you know, I don't know what the budget is, but I would guess it's over the last 20 years, it's been hundreds of millions of dollars that taxpayers have spent out at that research facility. Did you look at that at all, and did you feel like the research that's being done at that facility is being brought into practical road construction, and is that facility paying for itself? Is that a good value for the taxpayers? Did you feel like that research is being brought into the construction process?
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, first of all, I have to say we did not evaluate Minn Road itself. However, we did look at a lot of the research that came out of MnDOT, especially in the area of the thin white topping, because a lot of that work that the Minn Road facility has done over the years related to use of thin concrete overlays has been useful and was a part of the work that was involved with the study I referred to that ended at the end of 2013, led by the University of Pittsburgh. So we know that at least in this instance, the past work done through the Minn Road Research Facility was used to help reach some conclusions that now has kind of paved the way, so to speak, to use thin concrete in more applications for road rehabilitation.
Great, thank you.
Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the witness, and I don't know if you have this book with you or not, could you just refer to page 41? And to that chart, if you will, I just want to make sure I'm reading it correctly. Basically, it seems to say that to me, at least since 2005, the cost of bituminous, I'm sorry, over concrete has nearly doubled. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, indeed, that you are reading this correctly, that although both have gone up a bit, and you can see there's some up and down there, but that the cost for bituminous has increased considerably more in that last 9 years or so when compared with the cost for concrete.
And Madam Chair and to the witness, is that just the price of oil? Is that probably what drives that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, that's one of the leading indicators that explains the increase in the cost.
Okay, thank you.
Who's next? Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. My question is about alternate bidding, and maybe you can't answer this. Maybe it's better put to the department, but we'll try. As I look at the information that you provided, and I'm looking on page 61 of the blue book here, but it's talking about alternate bidding and that only 6% of all road projects over the last 5 years were subject to the alternate bidding. And then you talked about the percentage of those that were awarded to bituminous contractors. Do you have a sense of the reason why we're not seeing a larger number of alternate bids? I mean, we talked about 50% of the projects didn't include an alternate bid from the concrete industry, let's say. Do you have a sense of why, and can you shed some light on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative, there has been a limited number of the alternate bid projects just because these have been somewhat of pilot cases, so to speak. They do involve more work for the department, but the department has pretty aggressively taken steps to try to get more projects tested as alternate bidding. The concept itself is something that is relatively new, and in fact up until like within the last year or year and a half, the Federal Highway Administration didn't permit use of alternate bidding except on an exception basis. And so the ones that were done here in Minnesota were done on an exception basis. And so it is a relatively new concept in rehabilitation projects, not only in Minnesota but elsewhere. So, but I do want to point out that MnDOT, I think, did take some positive steps toward making sure that there were some possible alternate bid projects that could at least be put out to bid to both industries, because they thought that the value of increasing competition, perhaps leading to lower costs, was worth pursuing. And I know that they still feel very strongly about trying to encourage the use of alternate bidding, but that I think that they will agree, and you'll hear, that they also want to target that process on those projects where it is most likely to succeed. And I think that before, admittedly small sample of 26 projects, that there were some where the cost differences between the alternatives were just so great that it didn't attract the concrete industry to put in a bid. Exactly. Mr. Chair and Representative, as Jim Nobles just whispered to me, that the design standards for the thin white topping may permit us to get some additional examples, because there will have some additional work that brings in pavement alternatives that are going to be more closer together in cost. And those are the type that are really more ripe for successful alternate bidding.
Mr. Chair, and just a quick follow-up to that. I think I understand your answer, and that certainly explains why we only had 6% of all projects that were subject to this provision. But if nothing were to change in current practice or current law or current policy, looking ahead to the next 5 years, might we get the sense that that 6% would increase if we did nothing?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's hard to speculate. If nothing were to change, but the department still maintained its aggressiveness in trying to get some projects in through the alternate bid process, we'd probably see about the same, I would guess. But I think we'd also see the same results. That is, I think we'd still see projects where we're not attracting the bidding from both industries. And that's, of course, one of the kind of the ultimate purpose behind it.
Right, and I understand that, but to the specific point of the percentage of all road projects that would be subject to alternate bidding, might we see that number increase if we don't do anything based on the change in federal standard?
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, you're saying based on the change that the Federal Highway Administration made. I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. Again, that's speculation. I think that MnDOT probably is in a better position to answer that than I, because it really does depend on how well the department sort of embraces that process and encourages the districts to put together projects that do include alternatives from both the concrete and the bituminous side of things. I'm sorry that I can't answer to your satisfaction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll save the rest for the department.
There was a period, I was looking back for the chart where you show the asphalt increase in costs dramatically. Wasn't there a period when China was booming, really booming, and was sucking up all the cement out of worldwide, out of the United States and so forth? And shouldn't there have been quite an increase in concrete at the same time? And I don't see that in the chart. Maybe I do, and I...
Well, Mr. Chair, on that chart on page 41, there are increases. It's just that the increase relative to bituminous hasn't been as dramatic. If we were to show you just a chart that had only the concrete price over time, you would see increases. But this is relative to that base year of 1987, and then indexed to show the comparison between these two very different materials. So I think it's a little bit misleading in that respect. It doesn't show you, if we had a separate chart that showed just concrete with its prices over the years, you would see that, I think, a bit more evident than what you see here.
Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Hauer. I'm curious about the two recommendations that talk about estimating user cost and then the one that's for non-economic factors. Can you help me understand a little bit? Is this only pertaining to the scope of what you were looking at, the selection of pavement surface road rehabilitation, or does that apply to, could it be applied to all processes?
Mr. Chair and Senator, our recommendation is specific to this process of selecting between pavement types, because looking at user cost, we know from what has been done elsewhere around the country that the user cost for a particular type of pavement can be very different from the user costs involved with another type of pavement, especially when you look at it over a 35-year period. If one particular pavement alternative has got multiple times over that 35 years when the workers have to come back in and do rehabilitation, do maintenance, there are additional user costs involved there that will add up over time. So, yes, our recommendations are specific to this process.
Thank you.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to the testifier. From time to time, we get money from the federal government for some of our roads, usually not enough. But I'm just wondering if there are standards in place with the federal government or other states, particularly with the federal government, that would affect what we're doing here? You know, I'm thinking that we're not the only people asking these questions. Are there strings attached with the federal money as far as surface applications here?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, the federal standards do make a difference. When I said we did was identify the, in the national literature what are the standards that ought to be followed. Part of that national literature was what the Federal Highway Administration does recommend. It also includes things that came out of academia and other transportation-related organizations. But yes, we certainly looked at what the federal government, Federal Highway Administration recommends. So that's part of what, when we were building sort of this model of recommended practices, that was part of what we included.
Are there other questions? Please proceed, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So my question is, one of the questions was if there were no changes, but my question is this, excuse me, if you have adding full depth reclamation and thin topping, I would expect maybe that in the future 5 years, just the fact that you have those two added would probably end up in more bids or more projects that could qualify for the alternate bids. Would that be a fair conclusion?
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, again, I think that MnDOT is in a better position than I to answer this question, but certainly I think that having the standard now, the design standards out there for thin white topping, will, I think, open the door for more consideration of that, that particular technique. And use of thin concrete is going to be less costly than use of thicker concrete. So it seems to me that it is at least possible that, yes, we, as more of those projects are considered, that those could become projects that go through the alternate bidding process.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? I guess we're ready to move then to, I'm not sure, is John Sugarlow going to testify here or no? He's on, oh, there he is. I didn't recognize you without your steel helmet on.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to come and present to you and respond to the legislative auditor's report on our pavement determination. My name is John Chiglow. I'm the Engineering Services Division Director, responsible for our the materials office and our specialty office, materials office, that gives guidance to our districts in managing this process. I want to first thank, MnDOT first wants to thank the Office of Legislative Auditor for their professionalism and in-depth investigation into our process. And I think in the end, it is a very complex process, and I believe they recognize that as well. And I believe that their recommendations were very timely. We've been in the process of evolution within our department and evolving to a more transparent, financially effective department. And we are modifying a number of our processes and procedures. And some of those process and procedure modifications include how we do determine pavement determination in our department across our state. Some of those efforts currently consist of updating our pavement type selection procedures, refocusing our alternate bidding procedures, implementing findings from the Mineral Pavement Facility, which is an applied research facility, which is something that not only MnDOT takes advantage of, but multiple states across the country take advantage of, as well as private industry, establishing new pavement design methods, rewriting our pavement design manual. Over the last 20 years, pavement design, there's been an evolution strictly within the pavement design industry, and our pavement manual is now being updated and will continually be updated to keep in pace with new technologies like white topping or full-depth reclamation. And so with our new pavement manual, excuse me, in place, those updates and keeping in touch with the leading edge of innovation will be addressed within those updates of that pavement manual. So I'll quickly go through the recommendations and then be happy to answer any questions that might that the that you might have. The first recommendation associated with payment options and should include all possible payment options in project alternatives. We have a list, or our current process uses our payment management system, which is, as the legislative auditor mentioned, is based on historical data and tracking our payment surface performance. And then using that system, it makes recommendations on a type of fix that the districts then validate as they go through their process of a life cycle cost analysis. We will update, and we have informally updated our districts with recommendations from our materials office to look at options in terms of full depth reclamation or white topping. White topping is a new technology, new application for Minnesota. It's been used in other states more extensively, but as with any engineer, risk management can become a factor. I think we're starting to make some strides in our department and looking at how we can use white topping, just like we made strides in how we can use full depth reclamation as well. And so both of those tools will be included in our guidance to our districts as part of our payment manual. The next recommendation, MnDOT should update cost estimates in their life cycle cost analysis when such estimates are no longer current or no longer applicable to the projects. As many of you know, it takes quite a while sometimes to develop a project and ultimately get to construction. And so the project development process can take years. Early on in that project development process, some decisions need to be made in terms of the scope of that project, and one of those decisions is pavement selection. And so those are some of the challenges that we face in continually updating that life cycle cost analysis, because if we were to run a life cycle cost analysis much closer to the letting date, it could change our pavement type, which might require us to go back and redesign major portions of our project. And so timing is of the essence, and we agree to that. We understand that, and we're going to look at process to try to update that life cycle cost analysis closer to the letting, but we have to be careful that it doesn't become so close that it causes a delay in delivering that project. Some of those things we have to accept as engineers and owners is that risk, and when we make those decisions, there is an inherent risk that we have to accept that costs are going to escalate with commodities that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. Be it steel girder bridges or concrete girder bridges or asphalt pavement or concrete pavement, those commodities can be, the prices can be very dynamic, and we have to understand that as an industry and as an owner and take those things into consideration. So our process will be updated to make sure that our LCCA is current in relation to the project delivery and the scope of the project. It shouldn't be 10 years old. We believe it should be under 2 years old, and in terms of within 2 years of the letting, we should have an updated LCCA, and I think we can accomplish that. That doesn't give us a whole lot of discomfort in when we're developing our project, and it should be timely enough that we should be very confident in the numbers of the LCCA. MnDOT should include user costs such as time delay and vehicle operating costs when conducting a project life cycle cost analysis. This is, I think, kind of like a microeconomic, macroeconomic type discussion. MnDOT looks at user costs more at a macro sense, and I think the recommendation here is focusing on the microeconomics of it. Applying road user costs to pavement selection, it could be challenging. We do use road user costs on pavement selection in some instances. I agree it's not formal. It is more informal. But in as an example, if we're in a more rural part of our state and we are looking at two options of pavements, one option might require a lengthy detour. There might not be many detour options that would exist and would require a lengthy detour of 50 miles, for instance. There was one recently where the detour was 90 miles. In addition, 90 miles longer than the stretch of roadway where we were reconstructing. In that instance, we would recommend that you go to the detour, you look at road user costs and assess what those costs of those road users would be to manage that additional length of distance traveled. And in those instances, we would use road user costs to more so likely determine a pavement type. In a metro area, it becomes more complicated because there's multiple routes people can choose to use to circumvent our impact. And so really identifying the cost, actual cost to a road user based on all of the different options that that might exist could be much more complicated. We do track road user costs or road user delay to account when deciding to perform work between rush hours. At night or on weekends, you see in the metro area in particular, we do a lot of weekend closures or short-term night closures, and that is that's accounting for the road user impacts associated with those projects. We also use A plus B contracting that accounts for road user impacts as well. The A is the cost of the project, and the B is the road user costs associated with impacts associated with that project, or how long it takes from start to finish of an entire project, not just the pavement aspect of the project. And so in an A plus B contract, we have a dollar value that is accounted for per day of impact, and then we compute a cost to the road user, add it to the price, and ultimately that A plus B is used to determine the successful bidder on that project. This is something that we've been using more and more across our state, and we've been practicing this for about 10 to 12 years. And so these are tools, and we'll continue to look at opportunities to look at road user costs for pavement selection in the future, and we'll look at some formalization of that in our pavement manual as well. Again, OLA recommends a more formal process to consider economic and non-economic factors. OLA recommends a more formal process to consider non-economic and non-economic factors affecting payment alternatives. And economic factors would be initial cost, rehabilitation costs, maintenance costs, user costs, and life cycle costs. And you can see on figure exhibit 3.9 of the report that there's a list of non-economic factors that would be recommended. Thank you. And challenging to objectively quantify and justify on a project-specific basis. These things can be they can somewhat be ambiguous, but we do take these into consideration, again, informally. Weighing the non-economic factors against actual economic parameters can alter the impact of real budgetary constraints. These costs can escalate quite quickly and can be quite large and overwhelm the budgetary constraints that we use to ultimately make decisions on the ultimate scope of a project. And so that adds another complexity to using it specifically for pavement alternatives. And then but we will consider to use these non-economic factors on a programmatic or broader project specific related matter, or more of a macro project approach. And they are valuable. We do take all of these factors into consideration. If it's noise during construction, I'm managing a project now where we've required the contractor to do work during a certain period of time to minimize the disruption because of noise associated with the work of that project to the neighbors. And so there's things that we do more informally, but it's ingrained through our experience in the department to account for these issues or concerns as we develop projects. The next recommendation is related to statutory requirement 174.185, and this is the equal design life. This is something that MnDOT it would be consistent with MnDOT's position would be to repeal this. The following recommendation would be to modify its alternate bidding process to focus on projects where alternate bidding is likely to reduce the project's overall cost. we've been using alternate bidding for 3 or 4 years. Initially, we were looking at using it on all of our projects. I think what we've been learning, even though we haven't had the bidders, we haven't had the multiple bidders in the projects that the OLA have called out, we still have been learning from that. And I think we're taking those lessons and applying them more effectively, and applying this process more effectively, because I think we believe it's a good process to introduce that competition between the industries when we can, when it makes sense. And so I think we've been evolving again. Our process has been evolving, and I think we'll be applying this process when we can, when it makes the most sense. Our goal, obviously, is to use the actual contract prices at the time of letting to create competition and ultimately help make that determination of what pavement is the most effective, as long as we're comfortable with both pavement designs in that situation. But as was stated in the legislative auditor's presentation, we haven't generated interest in all of our projects, which is a concern of ours. We've been working very closely with both industries to understand why. I think in some instances our designs are comparing apples to oranges. And so they haven't been competitive for one industry or another, and we're trying to understand what's driving that. And then we'll also hire a consultant to help us evaluate the past alternate bidding processes and come to us with recommendations and working with the industry on what is the best practice in using alternate bidding in our moving forward into the future. In conclusion, it is in the best interest of our state to have a healthy concrete and asphalt industry. Some states only have one, and the competition, I think, is healthy. It gives us more alternatives, options, and how we solve our problems. And sometimes asphalt is the best fix in a certain situation. Sometimes concrete is the best fix in a certain situation. And so having that option and that flexibility to solve problems as engineers is a valuable tool for us in managing a 12,000-mile system. The condition of the network and the financial constraints that we have changes the type of projects we deploy. Currently, we manage about 700 miles a year in our program on a year-to-year basis. And in order to sustain it, when you look at our remaining service life over the last 10 years, it's dropped off significantly. And so the financial elements, and I'm sure you hear enough about this, but the financial elements associated with how we make decisions is a very driving factor on how we scope projects and ultimately determine the fix that we use on a specific area of roadway. And I think the decisions that we've had to be making because of the financing and the funding that we have available to manage our 12,000-mile system and the deterioration that we're seeing in our system is showing through that declining remaining service life within our system over time. We need to continue to look for choosing the most appropriate fix, and this is, as engineers, this is what we're about, choosing the most appropriate fix for the highest return on investment. And obviously we have that financial constraint there as well. Properly selecting the most economical payment is the priority. We want to, if we're comfortable with either choice, and we give a good comparison between concrete and asphalt, we're very comfortable with allowing the industry to choose by pricing what alternate is ultimately selected, and that's what our goal is with alternate bidding. We'll continue to monitor and work with AASHTO and the Transportation Research Board and other states. With MinRoad, we have a partnership called Terra that includes multiple states, multiple industry leaders that pool funds to help fund applied research and ultimately generates benefit for multiple states and multiple agencies. And so cities, counties, states all benefit from what we're doing at MinRoad. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you for your time.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The number of variables in making this decision, you know, just are mind-boggling. And do you, I mean, putting a formal process together, is that possible? And do you, you know, can you use a computer? Is that, is a computerized, you know, inputting of all the variables a way that you go about it? Is that possible?
Mr. Chair, there are quite a few variables. Soil conditions can be a significant factor in what we do, as well as geometrics, as well as safety. So there's a lot of variables. The pavement management system that we use, that's managed centrally within our department, helps address the conditions, the surface conditions that we see on the pavement, and looks at it from a system-wide perspective, not just from a project-wide solution. And so there's a number of tools that we can use. Not all of these factors can be taken into consideration in every instance. In every project, in some ways, not all, but in some ways is very unique. And so through formalizing the process, it will help make us more consistent in how we apply these factors and take things into consideration when possible. But I think there needs to be some flexibility in the process to allow the engineers that are out there working to take their own training into consideration as well. But it is important to formalize our process so that there is some consistency in our results across our state.
And Mr. Chair, just one other question.
Representative Runbeck.
I heard you say that there are times when you let the vendor make the decision about the type of pavement. Is that, how often does that happen, and is that the right way to go, or what?
Mr. Chair, and that is what's premise is behind, that's the premise behind alternate bidding. And we provide two pavement designs that we believe are comparable, and that's the key. We believe are comparable. It's not always easy to get two comparable pavement designs. But we provide the two that we're comfortable with and allow the industries to, through pricing, to determine which one should be used. There are processes that we would allow, that we could pursue in terms of performance specifications, where we say this is the performance we expect over a certain amount of time. But across the nation, that's generated some concern, because with those performance specifications come warranties, and bonding associated with those warranties is problematic, and so it creates some challenges. But allowing the industry and the competition to make some of these decisions, as long as we define the parameters they're working within, I think is a valuable approach and something that we should look into.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to bring my question back to the alternate bidding process. And I'm looking partially at this blue book. I don't know if you have this in front of you or not, but I'm on page 61. And we heard a little bit about the fact that only 6% of the projects over the last 5 years were subject to the alternate bidding process. I think I understand the reason why now. But what kind of bothers me, and what I don't understand, and hopefully you can shed some light on, is that of the 26 projects that were subject to alternate bidding, only 4 or 15% were awarded to concrete contractors. Now, we also know that 50% of the projects didn't even warrant a bid from a concrete contractor. But as I look down towards the bottom, in the second to last paragraph, it says that in another 7 projects, or 27%, only one contractor bid on concrete, and none of the concrete bidders were awarded the projects. And I guess that really is the heart of my question, is that in these 7 projects, or 27%, only, you know, we had concrete bidders, but none were awarded the projects. And it seems to fly a little bit in the face of the chart that's back on page 41, which kind of highlights the difference in materials prices between concrete and bituminous. And as I look at this other document that was handed out as you were speaking, there's another chart in here that kind of highlights the difference in cost between paving, asphalt, and other materials such as concrete. So I guess I'm wondering, you know, if concrete truly is cheaper than bituminous, and I guess we can't force concrete bidders to bid on projects, but in certain cases it looks like they have, but in none of those cases, or 27%, they weren't awarded the project. Can you shed some light on that, please?
Mr. Chair and Representative, since 2002, the price of asphalt, when MnDOT tracks the commodities and the pricing that we see for a ton of asphalt, things have evolved, specifications have evolved. There's a number of reasons. Oil prices is part of it, but there's cost increase in concrete or cement as well. But since 2002, there's been increases in both. Asphalt has increased more than concrete. It doesn't mean that concrete's cheaper. I think the best way to place it is we got to find the proper application for each. There's instances where concrete pavement, an application of concrete pavement is the best solution, but some of the reasons that driving our decision is that we don't have the funding to pay for that concrete, longer-term concrete fix. And so we have more flexibility. We've had more flexibility in asphalt by reducing the design. Instead of a thick overlay, if we have the money, we can go to a thinner overlay in asphalt. Now with thin concrete overlays, we have more flexibility to look at concrete as an alternate in those instances. Instead of a 30 or 50-year fix or 60-year fix, we can look at a 20-year fix in concrete, which until recently we didn't have that option. And so we were the funding that we had available was driving some of our design decisions. And so that's what's behind some of this. The other aspect of your question is, why aren't we using concrete more? I think part of it is funding, and concrete is a very good product, and so is asphalt. I don't want to begrudge anybody here, but I think we're learning as an agency on how to look at the two types of pavements and more effectively provide a more comparable design. When you look at our life cycle cost, there's usually, in the end, a factor that we use and apply to an asphalt bid that increases the price of that, because there might be, over a certain period of time, there might be more costs that increase the cost of maintaining that pavement over its lifetime. Understanding what we're doing in that lifespan of that asphalt versus what we do in a lifespan of concrete is important, and applying that consistently is what we're learning as part of this process, and working with both industries and understanding why alternate bidding is struggling like it is. And so I think our discussions with the industries have helped. We've obviously, neither industry is probably completely happy with us, but we're making some improvements to our process. We're really understanding how we should be applying alternate bidding in situations that really make sense to get the competition that we're seeking, and allow the industry to make some of those choices. But there's instances that we've chosen to use asphalt, and there's instances where we've chosen to go to a longer-term fix in concrete. But it's the middle ground in these alternate bid areas that we have to understand and accept a little more risk in some of these newer technologies, to create a little more flexibility in how we solve some problems in terms of thin concrete overlays or whatever it might be.
Mr. Chair, real briefly, one follow-up. And I understand what you're saying, and I don't disagree with you, but in the case of the 6% of the projects over the last 5 years that MnDOT said was subject to alternate bidding, I've got to presume then that MnDOT believes that concrete is a viable alternative, at least in those 26 projects. Is that's a fair assumption, right?
Mr. Chair and Representative, most definitely. We do not want to we want to keep our flexibility, and concrete is a very viable opportunity when it's applied in the proper application.
So if that's the case, then we had 7 projects and that concrete bidders did submit a bid on the project. None of those were awarded to the concrete bidder. Is it a safe assumption that it was directly related to the cost of the project?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that's something where I probably didn't answer your question fully enough. I think some of it is driven by the design and not having a comparable design with one another, more apples to oranges. And so some of it's driven by design, some of it's driven by the locality and availability of materials. There can be a variety. Some of it could be driven by impacts of the road users in the time. It could have been an A plus B job that we were doing. I don't have all the details, and we'd be happy to sit down with you and go over those if you'd like, and kind of talk through what we've diagnosed as some of the issues that some of the issues that drove the limited competition that we saw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have not that much time left here for the length of some of these questions, which is probably the reason why the legislature shouldn't be making decisions about what goes on what road. But anyway, we could like to speed this up as make your questions once and not lengthy. So we can do one more hearing. We have some folks from out of town. And the next person is Representative Petersburg that wants to ask the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, testifier, for bringing this forward. I know that the competition between the two industries has been contentious for a long time, and we probably won't resolve them now as well. But I'd like to go back to the discussions about non-economic factors, which, first of all, I don't really like the term. Since we can measure it economically, then it really is an economic term. And for those of us that are sitting in detours and others, we do find it as an economic concern for us. And because it is related to taxpayer, and I fully understand that it is difficult to evaluate these economic factors in regards to time spent in line, the amount of extra miles and so forth, it does seem to me that once the system is developed, it will become much easier in the future to develop the formulas and various other things to determine that. So once it's done, wouldn't you say that it's something that would be easy to continue on into the future?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Sigal.
Representative, I think it's important for us to, one, formalize the process so that we can be more consistent in how we apply them. And I think once we're formalizing that process, we'll have the data. It's less intuitive based on our experience and more data-driven in how we apply these factors. So I think it there could be some value added associated with that. Some of the challenges might be that we rely purely on the data and not on our intuition as engineers and experience as engineers. And so we got to find a balance between those two. I think as a DOT, we completely agree with you, Representative, about the it still impacts taxpayers. These are important factors. Noise is something that irritates a lot of people. And so, over the years, we've modified our concrete design so that the noise generated from concrete pavement is about equal to the noise generated off an asphalt pavement. And so we are recognizing these parameters, and we're modifying our standards in some ways to address some of those concerns.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. And it's kind of a follow-up on what we've been talking about. I did see one of the sentences here that material engineers are frustrated because of the lack of competitive bidding, and that's just trying to get a better answer as to why people wouldn't want to be bidding.
Mr. Chair, I think one of the benefits that we'll have by developing a pavement design manual and continually updating it is it will provide more consistency in how we apply our standards. And I think there has been some inconsistent approaches in how we've applied our standards in designing both pavement types. And I think that's something that we're focusing on and within our process. And overall, we're looking at trying to be more financially effective as a department. And I think we need to, when we're looking at alternate bidding, it makes sense that it's a financially effective tool to be using to allow industry to drive some of the competition. And I think more consistency in how we apply our standards so that we do have comparable pavement sections from concrete to asphalt is something that ultimately that's our goal. When we use alternate bidding. And so I think some of it is driven by comparing apples to oranges in pavement sections. Some of it's driven by other factors associated with what contractors look at they may not have the crews to go and work during that period of time. And so MnDOT's doing things to try to bid these projects earlier, so they have the contractor has more flexibility to schedule work throughout the year versus coming in and letting our projects in April through June and having from July to October to finish their work. And so letting them in September through March of each year and allowing the contractor from April to September or October to finish their work is going to provide more flexibility and ultimately maybe open up more capacity for the industry as well.
I have four more people, and then we'll have to cut this off and move on. Senator Kiffmeyer, Representative Swatsky, Representative Rosenthal, and Senator Jensen. Senator Kiffmeyer, you're next. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that's come to my attention here is that in 2002, MnDOT itself issued a report, and in that report they stated that white topping was more economical than asphalt. And that was prior to asphalt skyrocketing. And yet here we are today that only this year in 2014 did the department use white topping and come up with design standards. I think to the discussion of why there aren't bidders, this in itself, but what's puzzling to me is MnDOT itself back in 2002. Can you respond as to why it's taken, 12 years to get to putting design standards in place for white topping when they issued their own report in 2002?
Mr. Chigwell.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I'm not familiar with that report. I think it does take some time to implement new technology, especially as an engineer. Sometimes people can be risk averse, and I think it's something that we are looking at now and we're applying now, but it has we have applied it at MnRoad to understand the performance and how it should be applied. That's the value of a MnRoad facility. It allows us to apply the research and these conclusions that we're drawing and monitor its performance over time. Is 10 years too long? 12 years too long? I would probably tend to agree with you. And I think we're working hard as an agency to try to implement innovation in a much quicker manner so we can be more responsive to concerns of the industry, concerns of our ultimate, the taxpayers, is who we are responsible for managing taxpayer dollars of. And so MnRoad is applied research. We've been monitoring the performance of white topping for a few years out there, and we've seen very good performance in the sections that we have. And we're trying this process in other areas of our state now in actual implementation on our roadways.
Mr. Chairman, I just have another. I'm sorry. I know it's hard for you to see me, but I appreciate that, Mr. Shigalow, and I do think that 12 years is beyond, and I think I'm glad to hear some recognition of that. Also, in late 2012, the FHWA issued some guidelines for alternate bids, and also in MIT, the LCCA procedures were also issued. And so I think I appreciate the risk averse. I think you're dealing with, hundreds of millions of dollars. So I certainly recognize that consideration, but appreciate the risk averse. I think you're dealing with, hundreds of millions of dollars. So I certainly recognize that consideration, but these guidelines, alternate bids, LCCA procedures, are they being used as a part of MnDOT response? I mean, because I would think that would help on some of your risks if you use some of these things like MIT and the FHWA.
Mr. Chair and Senator, we are a lot of times what Federal Highways will do is develop guidelines that give broad parameters, and in order to use it on our projects, we need to fall within those parameters. And so I'm confident we are falling within the parameters of the Federal Highway guidelines. And so to answer your question, yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Swatsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure how this question might connect with this particular study, but since we are talking about, and I'd like to refer to the graph again on page 41 and the price of bituminous and the high costs of oil. I believe that there's a study being done in northern Minnesota. Don't ask me where, but using recycled asphalt and extracting some of that oil or recycle that for our roads. Is that, and you don't have to, we can talk about it offline, but I just wanted to know where that, is that a viable tool, or is that something that we are not being able to use? And if it's longevity, you know, those kinds of things, that because I think we do have a lot of piles of used in or that we could recycle, or, you know, piles of asphalt around the state of Minnesota. So we can talk about it later, but it, does that have any impact on any of this study?
Okay, so Mr. Chair and the representative, I'm sorry. I just need to validate what our specifications allow. You're right, there are a lot of large piles of recycled asphalt pavement that are stockpiled around the state. We've allowed for years up to 30% of the mix to be recycled asphalt pavement. There are some specifications that might drive that down, up or down, below 30%, depending on how the contractor wants to design that pavement. But we do allow it, and it is a valuable tool. And it's to us, it's environmentally right to recycle whatever we can out of our product. But there are some unique design issues that may come up if you go above 30%, but we'd be happy to sit down with you and go over that with you if you'd like.
Mm-hmm. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. I'm going to follow up a little bit of what Representative Simonson and Senator Kiffmeyer said. My own experience, if I'm on asphalt, I'm always much more comfortable that the road's going to be in better shape than asphalt. And I'm just curious as to when you decide between asphalt and concrete and there's a cost to the user, does one of the uses, say asphalt or concrete, what is the timeline on those? And is one faster to put down than the other and thus saving time in your mind to the user?
Mr. Chair, Representative, is one faster than the other?
As far as completing from beginning to end of project?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think it would depend on the project. I think there's you might be able to gain speed in using asphalt in the short term, but you might have a longer term fix if you use concrete. And so the turnaround to the time of impact to the road user is much longer when you use a concrete long-term fix versus a shorter-term asphalt fix. And so you got to find a balance between what is most appropriate for the situation. And so that's where I say there's a proper fixes with asphalt, there's proper fixes with concrete. And taking the road user into account is definitely a factor. You might be able to apply asphalt quicker on the short term, yes. Concrete, it takes a while to cure and get the strength. You can do some things to try to accelerate that strength gain. But when you open up a roadway and do a longer-term fix with concrete, there's more culvert fixing. There's more long-term fixes that are incorporated into that project scope because you don't. When you invest the money, you invest for a long-term fix. You don't want to have to come back and fix culverts within a few years. And so asphalt, you have some flexibility, but your scope might not be as involved, might not be, on specific projects.
Right. Mr. Chair, I think that was exactly my point, is that asphalt is easier in the short term and may, in some instances, be chosen over concrete just for that factor. And in the long term, it's, in my opinion, not as good a solution.
Mr. Chair, I think there's appropriate fixes for asphalt and appropriate fixes for concrete. And I think as a DOT, I think we'd be misleading if we made a blanket statement, but I think we have to look at the scope and the project and the location and the soil characteristics and all of these factors to make the most appropriate decision.
Thank you. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question revolves around page 56 on the weighing factors, again, of the economic and non-economic factors. And the finding in the report is that the Department of Transportation does not have a formal process used routinely to evaluate the combined economic and non-economic factors affecting pavement alternatives. And then it goes on to explain that the current process is that you can use some of that as long as it's justified, and that you can get receive approval from the district engineer. So when you were talking about micro versus macro, when you during your testimony, is it the department's position that although you do use some of that now, that you're not willing to create a formal process that would bring in those and still continue to do it the way that you currently do through the alternative, non-formal, exception basis?
Mr. Stiglo.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I think we are, when I was referring to macro, I was referring to a broader project perspective, because in many instances when we have a project, the scope might not just include pavement. And so there might be bridge replacement, there might be expansion, there might be a lot of different things that are occurring. And so we take economic and non-economic factors into consideration from a broader project perspective, looking at all of the impacts associated with the scope on the road user, not just the pavement impacts. And so I think, to answer your question, if we're willing to, I think we are willing to consider these factors more broadly, but I think we have to really understand how those that consideration is going to affect the overall determination, to make sure that because we need a process really to apply each one of these to a project, if we're going to compute a cost associated with each one to a project, to a pavement type. And so without a process in place, we're going to be very inconsistent in how we're applying them. And so it's a very involved analysis that we need to do in order to really fully understand how these things can be applied in a fair way, so that we're not favoring one industry or another, and really addressing the appropriate fix for the situation.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair, just real quickly.
All right.
One more thing. So when it says in here, in each project's materials designed recommendation report, you wouldn't be doing that.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we're
that's top of page 57.
Okay.
It says part of the analysis in each project's materials design recommendation report. That's what they're talking about. And you're talking about, well, we would do it, but not when it comes to material.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the materials design recommendation report is when it comes to pavement, it's primarily focused around pavement. There's other things in there, but that's really what it refers to. And so I think we need to look at these factors, but I think before we finalize them and make it a formal process, we need to understand how each one can individually or collectively impact the decision, so that we're not favoring one industry or another. I think it's important, as I mentioned earlier, that we have healthy concrete and asphalt industries, and we have to understand how, through some research on how we can apply these so that we're not adversely affecting one or the other.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and we're going to move now quickly to Matt Sellers, Concrete Paving Association, and Phil Thomas from the Minnesota Asphalt Pavement Association. And I would like to both of you come up here, and at each end of the table was enough separation between the two of you so they can't reach each other. We're going to give you about 3 minutes apiece, because we have Mr. Zeller, would you like to begin?
Sure. Again, thank you for inviting allowing me to testify and comment on the auditor report. For the record, my name is Matt Zeller. I'm the executive director of the Concrete Paving Association of Minnesota. 3 minutes. Got a lot more comments. I passed around a handout that wraps up our comments. I followed the same format MnDOT did, that had the auditor's recommendations. Then I included our comment and MnDOT's response. So I just wanted to expand on a couple of those. First, on MnDOT should identify a full range of feasible project alternatives. We agree with that completely. We also believe that pavement options should not be limited based on the type of pavement it is. I.e., concrete options should be included for short-term fixes. John Chiglow mentioned about the short-term, long-term, 20 years, 35 years. most of our concrete pavements, even in the new design process, call for a 20-year design. Many of the asphalt options don't, most options, short, what are they, thin, medium, or thick asphalt overlays, don't require any sort of formal design, so they're based off of historical. So a thin overlay could go out against an alternate bid, per se, against a thicker concrete that might be a 35-year fix. Again, we're working through this, but we still have a lot of very conservative ideas used when we look at our concrete overlays. Senator Kiffmeyer got ahead in your handout I gave you is a cover sheet and just the abstract for a report that was developed in 2002 relating to Highway 30 that we built in 1993, where we did a few concrete overlays, or a majority of the project was a concrete overlay, 5 and 6 inch, and a couple other attributes as far as the concrete overlay went, and also compared it to 3 inch and 5 inch asphalt overlays. And those are the conclusions of that report. As of 2002, the most economical overlay design in the study was a 6 inch thick bonded white topping. Based on recent observations, it appears white topping is a good performing and economical rehabilitation option for low volume roads in Minnesota. Again, that is all based on actual prices. Those comments are also repeated in the conclusion. So again, we agree that MnDOT needs to look at a full range of alternatives, but we also agree that, you know, that things need to be taken into account for the thicknesses. I mean, like I said, we have a minimum thickness for concrete. And again, that goes back to John's comment about the resistance to change. We at MnRoad, we put 3 inches on the interstate, and it went for 7 years. And I would challenge that 3 inches of concrete took more loads than the majority of the highways on the state system in the state. Yet we have a 5-inch minimum for our overlays. I'm not sure why, again, other than the resistance to change. The second point that I'd like to expand just a little bit on is, again, the recommendation that MnDOT should avoid calculating life cycle costs with inflation. And, again, a life cycle cost is only as good as its estimates that are used to develop it. Again, Senator Kiffmeyer jumped ahead. Within your packet there, be a page or two behind, is a memorandum of understanding between the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the Colorado DOT, where MIT has offered to come and help develop a life cycle cost that really incorporates all things involved in that life cycle cost, not just today's cost, but also includes uncertainty in what's going to happen in those repairs, the variability of timing, and also the costs. So, again, this is something MIT has been working on for 5 years.
Give you one more minute. Okay. Just got to move.
Yep, I'll wrap up with this comment. MIT has been working on this for 5+ years and has offered their help to MnDOT as part of their implementation. I think that would be a great help. Also, I included in there is, again, a national look at what's going on with pricing over the past several decades, back to the early 70s. I just noticed today there's a couple of typos, but it's that chart that says PCA, asphalt and other building materials, and CPI annual rates. You can see that this is not just a blip from the 2000s. That asphalt has had a higher inflation rate over decades. And when you don't consider inflation, I grabbed a chart out of one of MnDOT's, the 20-year MnChip program, and it shows even within MnDOT's program what's going to happen to the buying power due to inflation. So again, I believe that if we eliminate inflation, it's only going to hurt us in our estimating. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thomas. Please. Same amount of time.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. I am Jill Thomas, the MAPA Executive Director and Civil Engineer. MAPA is Minnesota Asphalt Pavement Association. And I do have some testimony here, but given time constraints, I will plan to email and mail you folks that information rather than taking up too much of your valuable time. MAPA members are committed to the state of Minnesota and its overall quality of life. It is our mission to serve our membership by advancing technology of asphalt pavement to the customers, and we strive to accomplish this with a staff of engineers, providing technical assistance, training, and consultation. We at MAPA agree with several aspects of the findings from the Office of Legislative Auditor's report. Life cycle cost analysis is a very complex topic and issue, and it should be left to experts. Transportation funding is what I wish we were here to talk about today. However, I do want to raise a few points regarding what was said today and also the report. In the alternate design bid process, the low bid is what is used to determine what goes asphalt and what goes concrete. The reason why those projects have not gone concrete is because they were not the low bid, taking into account initial dollars and future dollars. I would also call to your attention that on page 41, that chart is a price index chart and should be looked at accordingly. And if you were to look at MidNet's data from 2011, 2012, and 2013, you can see asphalt prices have remained somewhat stable and concrete prices have really fluctuated quite a bit. Concrete prices are above the asphalt prices in this chart. I will submit that with my testimony in the email as well. Minnesota Department of Transportation does meet most of these requirements for pavement type selection process, and they have asked the industry to be at the table, and we've been very grateful to be at the table with them. They do not evaluate, however, the user cost uniformly, both initially and in the future. We've all been driving along the interstates and seen the expensive concrete repairs and the time to repair those pavements. I would also submit to you that it's not just a detour issue, but it's the ease of construction and maintenance. A mill and overlay can be done at night and without user delay to most traffic. However, the concrete repairs, for instance, on I-694 are quite expensive and long-term. Takes a lot of time for the users to get through those pavements. I would also look at the concrete pavement repair costs, both estimated and actual. And you can see that there are several overruns on those repairs, as they are very costly. The issue about material-specific inflation rate, the report does show that, truthfully, it is not a simple process to forecast the inflation into the future.
1 minute.
Thank you. And they do show that it's difficult at 6 months ahead, let alone 35 years. So I would caution using a material inflation rate. We do not agree with the concept of white topping, as it is still new and, in my opinion, unproven technology. There's been numerous failures of these pavements, especially ultra-thin white topping sections, for many reasons, including joints in the wheel path that fail, premature cracking, and poor construction practices. White topping and asphalt pavement does not allow for milling the valuable asphalt pavement and recycling it back into asphalt pavement that we have. That is a sustainable practice of recycling material to put it back into our surface, and covering it with concrete pavement is extremely expensive to remove when it fails. So I caution you to use caution when using that unproven technology, in our opinion. And I look forward to giving you all my testimony in the future again. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you both, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from you in the future. I would like to ask Mr. Nobles, who I slighted you when you came up, and I was looking at my agenda. Would you like to say anything about your audit? Seems to me that it's thorough, and will keep us on the road again. Thank you both. Just briefly, if
Mr.
you want.
Chairman, just I want to thank you and all the members for taking the time during a busy legislative session to hear our report. I know this won't be the end of the discussion, but again, I hope that our report helps illuminate what is and will probably continue to be a very complicated process of decision making at MnDOT. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you. I think the senator is leaving us, but Representative Fritz, you want to bring everybody down, and we'll.
Senate members are welcome if you're super interested in Representative Fritz's bill, but otherwise I think that concludes our participation today. Thank you.
House File 3350. 50. Representative Fritz, would you like to explain what this is all about?
Thank
We're
you.
Only going to take about 10 minutes here, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you all for allowing us this opportunity to come before you today. And I'll be brief because of the time restraints, and all of the information that you probably need is in front of you. But House File 3350 informational hearing is about a road and bridge program prioritization in Medford, Minnesota. And I have with me today, and I'm going to just turn it right over to the mayor of Medford, Minnesota, which is in southern Minnesota, just south of Faribault. And her name is Lois Nelson, and she has some remarks that she would like to make about this proposal that she brought to me months ago. It's fixing the roundabout that's down there and a bridge that was built in 1957. We'd like to do those two projects at the same time so that it doesn't economically negatively impact the city of Medford. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll introduce or turn it over to the mayor.
Welcome, Mayor.
Well, thank you very much, and Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for letting us again share details of our collaboration with MnDOT District 6, Steele County, and the City of Medford. I'm Lois Nelson, mayor of this wonderful community. Where is Medford? We're a community south of the Twin Cities on I-35, located between Faribault and Owatonna. It's home to the first outlet center in the state, the second smallest community in the country to host a very busy McDonald's franchise, and the state's first roundabout on an interstate highway system. With these businesses and others on the west side of I-35 in our community, we are a designated regional retail site. For the past 3 years, we have been working with both MnDOT and Steele County as the roundabout, now 12 years old, is in need of a facelift and design updates realized with more technology and constructed roundabouts around our state. The I-35-48 exit is the key exit and entrance into our community. Originally, MnDOT scheduled this project, redoing the roundabout for the summer of 2013. At their August 2012 project open house, discussion included MnDOT, county, and city officials around the possibility of delaying this project to summer 2014 when the county had the adjacent replacement county bridge and County Road 12 reconstruction project scheduled. This agreement was made so as not to disrupt traffic into Medford for two consecutive years. An agreement with MnDOT was reached to delay the roundabout project to this summer 2014. The 60-year-old county bridge that crosses the Straight River from one of the roundabout exits is scheduled for replacement by the county to the very busy County Road 12, where our Central Avenue is scheduled for total reconstruction. The city has taken action to replace the water main from a 6-inch size to a 10-inch to further accommodate residential growth and possible access across I-35. The city's portion of this multi-million dollar project is around $450,000. City costs to be funded from a mix of utility bonds, special assessments, and general fund services used to repay general obligation bonds. The roundabout project has been bid, awarded, and is to commence the week of June 9th. Our county city project is out for bid right now to be open May 8th and awarded shortly thereafter. Now I've been made aware that the state's bridge funding may not fund all eligible bridge projects. We appreciate your support of Representative Fritz's House File Number 3350 so we can proceed with a funded project. I'd like to introduce our County Commissioner, Bruce Kubitschek.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Committee, for listening to us this morning. This project has been a real effort and a real good effort on everybody's part to put together something that will not interfere with the residents of this area for any longer than it would have to be. However, if it has hinges on one wild card, and that's bridge bonding. As you know, you have to have projects all ready to go before you can even apply for bridge bonding. And in this case, you know, we've done that. However, now we're waiting. Hopefully, we get that bridge bonding, because if we don't, that puts the county in a rather unpleasant situation. If we go ahead and honor our agreements with Medford and MnDOT, that means we'd have to pull approximately $1.5 million out of our other road funded projects to do this bridge. So it would make for some hard decisions on our part. So as you can see, this is a unique situation, but I think it's one that could be resolved in everybody's favor if we can fund that bridge. And just so you note on your information, I believe it states that bridge we're replacing has a sufficiency rating of 27.2, which is a very low rating, and as you can see, it's deteriorating quickly. So we do need to do this project. So I do appreciate you listening to us this morning and taking this into consideration.
Is that it for your testifiers?
Yeah, well, yes, it is. I do have the Steele County Administrator Tom Shea here as well, who might would like to say words. But I also want to say a few things, tell you that, you know, that Medford had a flood a few years ago. And, you know, and along with that and the recession, closing down this bridge and this ground about 2 years in a row is not going to help at all. And just when we're getting back up on our feet. So please take that into consideration. I'll turn it over to Representative Shea.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. won't even take that. I think this legislation reflects a real effort to be collaborative. We have been with MnDOT, with the city, with the county, to get the best bang for the buck on a major project and minimize the impact with the local community, which it will have. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Anybody from MnDOT that would like to say anything about this? Come on down. Hurry up.
Stay here.
Welcome.
Welcome, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rick Jonas, and I work in the State Aid Office of MnDOT here in St. Paul, and for most of the last 10 years, I have overseen the local bridge replacement program. I became aware of this bill late last week. Drew the short straw, worked through the weekend to do a little research to find out what the bill was about and prepare for some testimony here and possible questions from the committee today. First to the bill, House File 3350, which pulls out the local road improvement program section of law and the local bridge replacement program section of the law, and proposes to add some wording in there that the criteria must place highest priority on projects that are developed in conjunction with the trunk highway system project in a manner that minimizes traffic and community impacts and produces efficiencies. MnDOT has not had time to have full discussion within the agency to have a position on this bill, but I can say from the Office of State Aid, this wording seems unnecessary. And both programs, we have 41 bridges right now on our waiting list for funding. The program is essentially broke. We're waiting to see what the legislature is going to do as far as providing additional money for us. There are 44 other projects that are in process of moving through our review process. The plans are being verified and the field reviews for the location of the bridge being finalized and so forth. So we anticipate 85 bridges at a minimum wanting funding this year. The master list would apply that there's more like 150 bridges that locals will be submitting money this year if there's a substantial bonding bill. But 85 bridges for sure. 41 are actually shovel ready. We could put out tomorrow, including this bridge. This is one of those bridges. And in the local road improvement program, the criteria there, now all agencies are eligible, counties, cities, and townships, and the criteria talks about in the statute now currently that we have to take into consideration the availability of other state, federal, and local funds. We need to take into consideration the regional significance of the route. We need to take in the effectiveness of the proposed route in eliminating a transportation deficiency. The project described today certainly meets those criteria and would receive a good look at the chance of funding from our office. However, the local road improvement program right now has no money. There has been no money for quite some time. I think the legislature is looking at giving some money this year. The House has passed a bill to propose to put some money into that program. But I would suggest that these three of three of the six criteria that I just read to you right now essentially is the same as far as the impact on our decision making as the wording proposed in Bill 3350. So I wanted to make the testimony that I don't think Bill House File 3350 would do the program any good, and it might actually, due to the broad spectrum of projects and the broad spectrum of agencies that apply for these types of funds, that it would actually eliminate and make more difficult to administer the program across all local agencies as the programs are intended.
I think Representative Fritz brought this forth so you'd be thinking about this, because we're not going to have time in this session to pass anything into law. Representative Fritz, did you have a...
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Jonas, thank you for coming down, and I look forward to furthering our discussions over this particular project and with other projects, the other 44 or 85 bridges as well. But I'm talking also about Greater Minnesota and the needs out there. I also want to make a pitch for funding for the Local Road Improvement Fund, which is I think has been always not adequately funded. And I think, Mr. Chairman, that if you were to fund the Local Road Improvement Fund adequately, that a lot of these things could be taken care of. We wouldn't be here today if there were funding there. So please take a look, and all of you, at that, a much closer look at funding that, with not $10 million or $20 million, but a little more than that would really help us. And the amount of money also that you've given towards potholes. You know, that's a pothole here and a pothole there. I've got a lot of projects out in southern Minnesota that need a lot more work than just pothole mending. But thank you again for your work, and thank you for listening to me.
Thank you all for coming into town and testifying for this. We much appreciate it.
Thank you.
I have a set of minutes here that I'd like to have Representative Rosenthal move. Any questions or comments? March 21st. All in favor by saying yes.
Yes.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Before you bang that gavel down. I have a quick question, and I'm just curious. Are you planning on having another committee meeting this session?
I wasn't planning on having this one, as a matter of fact.
Then, Mr. Chair, I have a request, if I could, and I'd like to do it on the record, if I could. I'm hearing increasing concerns about budget reductions, especially in District 1 of MnDOT, and I'm curious about the rest of the state as well, the other seven districts. But I'm curious if we can put out a request to MnDOT about the status of the current fiscal year with terms of budgeting, as well as going in, you know, beyond June 30th. Because as we head into a busy construction season, I think the last thing any of us want is see some projects get reduced or suspended, and certainly don't want any layoffs. But I'm wondering if you could request an update on that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Adjourn.